Coming up on Hometown Alaska, host Kim Sherry learns about the history and traditions of Anchorage's Hmong community. We'll hear about what makes their culture unique, discuss Hmong New Year, Peña Market, and more. And on State of Art, join me, Ammon Swenson, as we revisit a conversation with Juno artist Crystal Worrell. She recently completed a massive mural in downtown Anchorage. That's all coming up next on Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media.
On Hometown Alaska, we sit down with a member of Anchorage's Hmong community to learn more about their rich history, traditions, and journey to Alaska. From Hmong New Year celebrations to favorite foods and the lively weekend market at Peña Park, we'll explore what makes this culture so vibrant and unique. Join us for a conversation that celebrates community, heritage, and connection right here in Anchorage. I'm host Kim Sherry. Today we're speaking with May Ramirez Zhang. May, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself first? Where did you grow up? Just give us a rundown.
Thank you so much for having me here today. I grew up in the Central Valley. My parents immigrated here to the United States in the early 70s, and I was born in the Central Valley of California in 87. We eventually made our way to Alaska. Currently, in my professional capacity, I work for the state of Alaska as the state's risk manager. But I do a lot of things outside of that, from organizing the Hmong Festival through our nonprofit HEART, which stands for Hmong, Empowering, Advocating, and Reforming Together, to operating the Peña Market on the weekend. And we do, just this year, we had started a new night market at the Glen Square. And it's every Friday night from 6 until the vendors are sold out. Just a place to hang out. There's children out there just hanging out on the grass. And we have vendors and food.
You sound busy.
Very.
So can you share a little bit about the history of Hmong people, where they originally come from?
So it's my understanding, and it could be wrong, but the parents have always talked about this. It's not written in history. We came from the area close to where China is. Prior to there being division of land, the Hmong people have existed in that area. Of course, there was conflict between China and Hmong, and we eventually migrated south to Laos, Vietnam, and Thailand. And we then continued living there. So the Hmong people made it home in the villages, on the mountains, up until 1961, where the United States came along during the Vietnam War and sought help in what we know now as the Secret War of Laos, where many Hmong men and children rescued down American soldiers. Eventually making their way to America.
How many Hmong families immigrated to the United States after the Vietnam War? And can you explain why the Hmong community chose the U.S. to come to?
I don't think they had a choice. Plenty of people in the Hmong community through the villages, they were sought out. There was a genocide performed on the Hmong people after the Secret War when the U.S. pulled out. They didn't have a choice but to leave where they lived, and they were hunted like animals. So because of their efforts, because of the Hmong leaders at the time who led the Hmong men and children into war to support the United States during the Vietnam War in Laos, and when they stepped out, when the United States stepped back, the Lao government at that point took over and performed genocide. So a lot of people crossed the Mekong River through that and got to Thailand in refugee camps. Mm-hmm. That was where they sought safety. And the United States at that point brought them over. I can't say for certain how many families came over, but I know that a lot of families came. And a lot of them had to be somebody who knew somebody who fought in the war. And in that time frame, a lot of other community groups took that opportunity to also come to Thailand and come to America because of the efforts of the Hmong people. It was a promise to the Hmong people that if they fought in this war and if everything worked out, great, because they were fighting, you know, one kind of, you know, one enemy, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. And when the United States pulled out, the Hmong people were left to fend for themselves. And eventually, people who were heavily involved in that started bringing the Hmong people, including one of the very famous CIA agent, Jerry Daniels, who was a pilot at the time. And he also helped very many Hmong families, you know, made it to America. My father was one of the individuals during the Secret War. He fought in that war. He led the people through that and to America. So
if they didn't somehow make their way over the border to Thailand and were stuck, they were just stuck. No one was coming to save them?
Yeah, there was no one coming. Eventually, over time, the shooting stopped. Eventually, the people, I hear that there's people there now, that there's, it's more peaceful now than it was back then. Mm-hmm. But during that time, everybody was, you know, a target.
Mm-hmm. So they make their way to Thailand and the U.S. helps to immigrate them. And then it seems like I've heard there are kind of hubs of where Hmong people ended up. I know Minnesota was one. And like you said, the Central Valley, my sister-in-law's family, she's Hmong. She's in Sacramento and they're in that area. How did these specific places come to be Hmong communities?
You know, it started with at least one person going there and bringing their families. Here in Alaska is a great example. So Central Valley, Minnesota, Wisconsin, they're all very, very big popular places with Hmong communities. Mm-hmm. And probably one of the largest Hmong communities in the States. In the late 90s, we came to Alaska. My parents decided that it was time to move away. And Alaska was one of them. I mean, never in my mind, even through elementary school, did I ever think that I would make it to Alaska or call it home. So when we came here in the late 90s, I think there was about 10 families. It was just kind of like word of mouth family.
Small.
So there was about, 10, 12 families. And we got up here. My father happened to be a very, very popular person in the community. He fought in the war. He's a colonel, a governor, a mayor. He served in several roles back in Laos. And so for a long time, he continued to lay low, but he did take it to the airwaves in the early 2000s to share with people that he has made Alaska home. Mm-hmm. The people now wouldn't remember this, but the parents probably does. Mm-hmm. And there was a huge wave of Hmong people that came at that time because my dad went to the lower 48s. He does the radios just as I'm doing now. And he shared his love for Alaska and the beautiful state that has so much to offer its people. And people were just flooding Alaska at that point. They're like, hey, he's there. His family's there. They have been there for a while. Before you knew it, there's so many people here now that I don't know every one of them, but it's just great to know that there's some Hmong people also calling this place home.
Definitely. How do you think those original 10 families chose to come to Alaska? Of all the places they could have chosen.
I was probably 10 years old at the time, so I wasn't a part of that conversation. Mm-hmm. I just knew that there was just, at that time in the 90s, a lot of gang-related stuff, and it was just trying to get away, save your family from that. And find a space further away. And Hmong people are like that. They like to, they'll first form a place and they're like, okay, now we have to move. where is the next survival thing? And it's so funny because the history of the Hmong people has always been that way. Mm-hmm. From the conflict in China, which the Hmong people fled down to the Southeast Asia, the conflict in Southeast Asia. Don't forget, they helped the French at one point, then the United States, and now here we are in the United States. We're moving from one area to another state, and a officially calling Alaska our home.
Mm-hmm. So when your family first arrived, what was it like?
Well, I will say that in the Central Valley, you don't see like really huge big buildings like you do on Fifth Avenue. That was the one thing that really made me thought, wow, this is a really interesting place. Like the buildings are very low. You don't see them go that high up. But of course, as you get older, you're like, oh, New York City and all of these other places. But that was really shocking for me, seeing huge buildings when you're driving through like Fifth Avenue. You're like, what is this place? And then, of course, the beautiful scenes, the mountains, the point. Oh, my gosh. Beautiful. Just seeing the airplanes come through. There's just so much about Alaska that makes it so lovely.
Mm-hmm. What was it like for your family incorporating into the community?
Here in Alaska?
Mm-hmm. Once you moved.
So when we came to Alaska, there was a few families already here, but they knew my father was coming. It was just weird to see how well-received it was. Mm. You have family bringing in rice, bags, food, just, it was such a close-knit, like, community. Mm-hmm. There was so much love and just so much sharing of everything. When one person did something, they'd share it with the other. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, we were a really small group at one point. Mm-hmm. And someone would make a list of telephone numbers, and everyone had each other's contacts. Of course, very small, but there was just so much love. We started out in Mountain View, mm-hmm. and I think we were one of the first families that moved to Turnagain area and the west side of town. We didn't do what the traditional Hmong family did, where they came in here and lived in Rangeview and started out in, you know, a trailer before moving and buying a home. We just had a larger family, and so we couldn't, you know, do that. But my parents had always made sure that the home was suitable for us. And so we were in West Anchorage with mm-hmm. one of the bigger homes. And there was quite a few of us. And so it was a really beautiful time at that time. But we did start out in Mountain View. And so Mountain View will always be home for me.
What makes Hmong culture unique and special to you?
The Hmong culture is so unique and dynamic in ways that it's really difficult to explain, especially for the very traditional families. There's things that we do that people don't understand. And it's like, why do you guys do that? But it's been things that are passed on from ancestors, mm-hmm. from families. Little things like superstitions and don't do this. And when you get married, this is how things are going to be. So training up your daughters and ensuring that they know what is expected of them outside of, you know, home with mom and dad, right? And what's to be expected of a daughter-in-law? How do you greet a person? Everything is just so structured in the Hmong mm-hmm. community. It's really difficult to say that, but there's just so much of that that I feel like anybody born into a Hmong family would feel stressed out. Oh my gosh, you know, waking up at 5 and helping mom cook, or, you know, there's just a lot of that stuff. But moms are always like training their daughters up mm-hmm. and lecturing them about, this is the way of life. You have to do this. You have to learn that, because when you become a daughter-in-law, and the word for daughter-in-law in Hmong is nya, when you become a nya, your mother-in-law is expecting this of you. You have to greet people this way. You don't serve the table with your hands above the bowl. Like, there's just so many little right. things about being Hmong, that the little things counts. And then there's a huge thing from when there's an event and you want to bless your family member, so you tie a white string on their hands. I mean, there's just so many things. And then, of course, the people who are traditional versus those who have decided to leave that traditional life behind, and they've decided that they want to go into Christianity. Mm-hmm. So trying to find that fine line between the traditional way of just who you are, what's culturally acceptable, what's traditional, what's mm-hmm. right, what's wrong, is this okay because we're Christians? You know, like, there's just so much of that right now that I think people are not too, I mean, there's just so much of like, is this appropriate? Like, mm-hmm. you know, this is traditional, but we're Christians. Can we do that? You know, and I think that naturally, if you're Hmong, you do what's Hmong. And even if you believe in God and you are Christians, there are certain things that you just can't bypass because you're Hmong. Mm-hmm. And you just have to accept that.
I was going to ask you, you know, as time goes on, and generations kind of happen, do you find that the younger generation is kind of like, no, mom, I mean, just because I'm Hmong, I'm not going to do that. Like, my friends aren't doing that. Their families aren't doing that. Are you finding that that's kind of happening, or are traditions still sticking?
I do feel like a lot of that happens during my time. Like, there was a lot of, mom, I don't think I should do that. No, mom, I don't feel like that's appropriate. But as we get older, I'm starting to see more and more children being more acceptant of being Hmong. Like, my daughter's not completely Hmong. I married, I'm a mixed race, you know, race family. My husband's Mexican. And there's just so much of her wanting to know more about being Hmong. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much of the young kids right now loving the tradition and cultures. And it's funny because I think like one generation to the next, like you skip one generation. You have a generation who just wants to avoid being Hmong because you have to be more American than you are Hmong, right? Mm-hmm. But then that generation has passed and it's like, now it's this generation. They're like, why are we suppressing what we are, mom? We need to be more Hmong. Like, you know? So it's a back and forth type thing. I do feel like a lot of us are losing our traditions. We're not remembering certain things. And a lot of it has to do with the elders. Like, we don't have a place where we can share this. We don't have a center. We don't have a, you know, just enough trying to preserve that culture, that tradition. And so that's kind of where I started, thankfully, with the vision of my father, who has felt that the Hmong traditions and cultures and just everything about Hmong is so important. He, like, instilled that in me. And his vision is what made our nonprofit possible, was because he had a vision behind that. And we're over here doing the legwork, but like, this is what we need to do. Mm-hmm. This is how you do it so that it's appropriate. If you want people to, you know, understand what you're doing, you have to do it this way. If you don't want people to disagree with you, you do it that way. So, you know, a lot of that stuff is being, like, I'm trying to glean as much as I can from him. He is pretty old now, and I'm just trying to ensure that he gets to see that a lot of the stuff that he's teaching us is going to be living on. Hopefully through the next generation to the next. So that's where the Hmong Festival came in. I think that when the children get to put on their nice, beautiful Hmong outfits and they get to wear it and hear it jingle, it's a beautiful feeling. And to be able to say that you are one of us, the Hmong.
So that brings me, the Hmong Festival, are you talking about Hmong New Year?
Yes.
Okay. So you'll probably have to clarify for a lot of people out there, because we have New Year's in America, January 1st, you know, December 31st, January 1st, fireworks, blah, 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 people go out, it's a new year. Hmong New Year is very different, and it doesn't have to be a specific time of year, but it is a big celebration. Is that?
Yes. So there's a lot of disagreement in the Hmong community about when a new year should start. A lot of them think that it should be like the American New Year, where it's like at the end of the year and then we're celebrating a new year, because that makes sense. That's what New Year is.
Right.
But in the Hmong, like, culture, our traditions, we have never operated with a calendar. Let's clarify that.
Okay.
It had always been after the harvest season. And it's not like it's celebrated whenever we want. That's not the way it works.
Right.
But at the same time, it is a gathering that takes place after the harvest season.
Okay.
So we, when the Hmong people didn't have calendars, they go by when the flowers bloom, when, you know, the season was a season when the pumpkins are, you know, like, so at this point, it would be after the harvest season. And usually after the harvest season, the community, wherever you are in the world, would come together and gather, and they celebrate. They celebrate their harvest. They celebrate the end of a season and a new year. And the new year is really like, you know, they're thinking not just about a new year, but the crops, the blessings from your ancestors, the blessings from, you know, God, you know. And so it's more than just a New Year celebration. I think that to translate it, it's not a literal translation. We call it a new year because it's like always supposed to at one point or another at the end of a year, usually at the end of a harvest season. Here in Alaska, our harvest season ends way earlier than everyone else. And I have always thought of it as a way of, you know, celebrating when it's appropriate for your season, for your state. So we started earlier when I took over the Hmong festival, the Hmong New Year, and I call it the Hmong Harvest Festival. Mm-hmm. I had initially just took on what everybody did and said it's the Hmong New Year. Doesn't feel appropriate here in America to say it's a new year.
Right.
Because we're not celebrating an actual physical new year. We're still here in the fall season. So to say that it's a Hmong Harvest Festival, everybody in the Hmong community knows.
Yeah.
We're celebrating. So we're still celebrating, so that the community understands that, okay, what are they celebrating? Why are they celebrating mm-hmm. a new year? Well, it's a harvest season. It's mm-hmm. ending, and we're celebrating. For us, we know it's a new year, but for the broader community, it would be confusing to them that
yeah.
we're celebrating a new year and we're still here in this current year. So that's where the correction came. In the past, there were other people in the community that did try to celebrate the Hmong Festival in December alongside with when other states celebrated. One of the conflicts that they've noticed too is they couldn't really give it the outdoor feeling that typical mm-hmm. Hmong people, when they celebrate, they have that.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the Southeast Asia and stuff, there's vendors. It's always celebrated outdoors. It was not an indoor type thing. And one of the conflicts that I've also noticed is that a lot of people leave during the cold season. They like to be mm-hmm. where the main festival is happening, and which is Fresno.
Mm-hmm.
Fresno, California is the biggest New Year. So to celebrate and to feel like we are one of the first states to kick off the season with celebrating the harvest season, the New Year season, whatever people want to interpret that as, I think it feels like it's an honor. There's so much that we do that I can see other states taking on, or like
oh, wow.
I remember hearing my dad making an announcement at our festival that, you know, in the next year to come, we should ensure that if there are people who are, and I'll have to explain this a little better, but if there are people who are single, they should wear like a green bracelet so that people know that they can be approached.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're married or taken, you wear a red bracelet. In the Hmong culture, one of the things that we do after celebrating a harvest, or after our harvest season, is when we celebrate, we come together. That's the one time that the community gets to come together. They will court girls. Guys will court girls. Girls are come prepared, dressed up in their beautiful outfits, and they would toss balls.
I remember this from, I went with my sister-in-law to the Hmong New Year Festival in Sacramento, and she explained the tossing ball game to me. So yeah, please explain to our viewers, give them a visual.
So what you would do is you would buy a tennis ball. The vendors would have one, right? And you'll look around for a girl that you believe might be single. Like in the Hmong New Year, usually only the single women would come dressed up in Hmong, or like really dressed up. And but here we do it as a fashion now. So it's not the typical thing. However, though, the guys would come with balls and they will find a girl that they are interested in, and they'll ask her, hi, you know, what is your last name? Because, you know, last names are important. And then also, would you like to toss balls? If she accepts, then she wants to engage in a conversation with you. And the tossing of the ball back and forth allows them to stay engaged, you know, and communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I can't do this, but the elders can. They will, I want to say there's like a folk kind of singing mm. that they do. And that's their way of, it's like a freestyle talking back and forth. And you'll hear them singing in their, you know, poetic way. Mm-hmm. And it's so beautiful. It's really hard for the young ears to understand what they're actually saying. But it's all poetic. And it rhymes, and it's like if you listen to it, it's like, oh my gosh, that sounds so great. You know, he's courting her and he's saying, you know, this and that. And she's like, if she's taken aback by it, she will respond with another. And it just goes back and forth until they decide that they want to exchange numbers or something like that. But now, of course, because we're younger and we don't have that ability to do that, it just starts with the conversation.
Yeah.
Guys just pick up a ball and say, hey, would you like to toss a ball? And usually if a girl says yes, it means yes. I don't know that that's what people are doing anymore. I feel like we are trying to keep the tradition alive, but a lot of people just do it just to do it, to have fun and to be in the moment. But it's still happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can find a ball, and everybody understands that it means somebody wants to court you.
Yep.
So
I love that. Can you talk about what other cultural traditions or celebrations are important in Hmong life?
I do know that the Hmong Festival is by far the most important one in the Hmong tradition and cultures, but there's so many things that are significant in the Hmong community. Weddings, funerals, those are the main stuff that are so important. If you are in a traditional household, though, most weekends you'll probably be stuck with your parents or mother-in-law with some kind of like shamanism ritual that they do to kind of bless the family on the weekends when someone's sick. We don't do that. I personally don't. I am also a Christian, and we've never practiced that in my family's household. But it was really an interesting thing to see, and that families still continue that. Mm-hmm. People call it Jingle Bell, but you know, I haven't seen them lately. Like, I don't know if it still exists, but I do know that it is something that is traditional that people constantly hold on to if they're traditional.
Mm-hmm. Are there special dances, music, or clothing associated with any of these celebrations? I mean, I know there are because I've seen them, but can you just describe to people like what it looks like and sounds like? Because you were talking about the bells.
So there are traditional clothing. Every woman's clothing tells a story about who she is. Her hat, her dress, the sleeves on her arm, like her shirt, it all tells her where... tells a person where she comes from. So when you see a person with a certain type of hat, you'll say, oh, those are the Hmong people from this specific area, mm-hmm. from this specific town. If you see them wearing stripe sleeves, we call them the stripe Hmongs. If you see them wearing, like, you know, certain outfits that resembles the Hmong people in China, we call them the Chinese Hmong. The interesting thing about our outfits is it does tell a story. People here in America, though, wear it as a fashion thing now. It doesn't really, like, do the whole, like, okay, where are you from type thing. It kind of does, but it doesn't. Mm-hmm. You'll know when someone's wearing it just for fashion, and you'll know when they were wearing it because that's where they came from, or that's who, that the type of Hmong they are. Mm-hmm. But yes, their outfits definitely tells a story. The moms would take, like, throughout the years, will stitch their clothes. This is back in the day, and would put little coins on there. The coins that you see on a woman or a man's clothing are French coins, and they were there since when the French was in the area. So the efforts of the Hmong people wasn't just for the United States. They have also helped France when they came to that area, and so. One of the funny things about being Hmong is there's just so many different things that if you don't know about us, it would not make sense. And it's just like, so why does that hat look like that? Well, mm-hmm. that hat means that they're from this area mm-hmm. of this country. So the beauty of being Hmong is that if you are Hmong, you'll know that every Hmong person, I can't speak for the ones in this generation or the younger ones, but every Hmong person speaks at least two languages. There's Hmong people throughout not only the United States, but in every country, really. There's people in Australia. There's people in South America. We have Hmong people in France and still the indigenous ones in China. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of like, just hearing that there are so many different types of Hmong people and learning the different languages of each country that we are in and adapting into that, mm-hmm. you know, society. It's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm host Kim Sherry. After the break, we'll continue to talk about the Hmong community in Anchorage. Welcome back to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Kim Sherry, speaking with May Ramirez Zhang. May, how large is the Hmong community in Anchorage right now?
You know, at one point I heard a couple of years back that there was about 5,000 Hmong members here. It could be more. Mm-hmm. And that was based off the U.S. Census at the time. But I've tried to do a research. I don't know what that looks like.
What role does the Peña Park Market and the weekend Hmong market and food trucks and festivals play in bringing the community together?
Well, I feel like it plays a significant role, not only in the Hmong community, but for East Anchorage and for all of Anchorage and places in Alaska. We have visitors and vendors from throughout Alaska. I have a vendor who farms in Kenai and comes up. So yes, it's Hmong majority, and it's a significant space because back in the early 2000s, there was a wave of Hmong people that also came through Anchorage through the refugee. I feel like there was a certain thing that happened in the early 2000s, like 2004. I was still in high school at the time, and I remember being pulled out. And we had this wave of Hmong people who didn't speak English that came in, and it had to do with one of the refugee camps closing in Thailand. Mm. United States fulfilled their promise to the Hmong people by bringing those individuals who were asked to be removed from the refugee camps because it was closing. I don't have the specific name now, but they came through, and Anchorage accepted several of those families. Mm-hmm. I was probably in junior high, and I remember being pulled out to go and interpret for these children.
Oh, wow.
That had started school. And it was very, like, kind of interesting for me because I don't do interpreting, at least not in high school. And so I was trying to communicate with the children and explain to them how school works. But looking back now, so the Pinya Market not only is just a market, it was part of something that the Catholic Social Services did at one point. Mm-hmm. They helped with the community gardens because these individuals had to adapt to the new society, but they wanted them to have what they always do, which was farming. So a lot of the community gardens was kind of put together because of these individuals that came through. So the little community gardens that you see popped up around town, there might not be a lot of stories about it, but it did start with a lot of them are Hmong vendors,
wow.
Hmong people. They're farming, and they have to have a place to go to do something with their veggies and to mimic what they continue to do where they come from is having a market. So Pinya wasn't always a market. It was a place where the Hmong people continue to meet. It's probably about 3 decades now.
Wow.
And we used to hang out there after, like, on the weekends or after school. And it was a side of town where the Hmong majority were. So it wasn't just a market. It was a hangout spot for a lot of the Hmong people. And what had happened was it eventually people started selling things there. And families started cooking and exchanging that. And people were like, oh, my God. Food here, you know, and we love papaya. There was ladies out there that would do papaya. And people started exchanging money for their food. And at one point or another, the city had gotten involved. Like, okay, well, this is not the way you have to do things. So that's where I came in. I also was helping this market for a while. It wasn't a market at the time. It was just coordinating to ensure that they were properly, you know, inspected, mm-hmm. properly, you know, permitted, mm-hmm. properly with everything. And I was working to help that for a while, but then they were going to close it. They're like, okay, we can't do this anymore. So some administration ago, they intended to close the market down. Mm-hmm. I had asked that they not do that because it's such a vital part of our community. Mm-hmm. You don't put something and set something up and then say, we're done, we're taking it away. So I had since then learned about a little bit more about business. I took a whole, like, my degree was in business administration, trying to learn more about running a business, mm-hmm. and turned Pinya into Pinya. Mm-hmm. So Pinya Park Market. Mm-hmm. And to be a safe space for people, those coming up in the community, those who want a place that's safe to operate without the brick and mortar, just, mm-hmm. you know, being in an area where they're comfortable and they feel like they can do what they need to do without feeling like, you know, there's all those restrictions. Pinya allows for that. We are a majority Hmong, but over the years, it's gotten so popular. Mm-hmm. I have brought in more diversity to the market. We have individuals from, you know, different groups, and just it's just beautiful now. And so it is a Hmong space, but because of who we are so open to allowing others to be a part of what we do. And we want to bring that to everyone here in Anchorage.
I have been to the Pinya Market, and I have had some of the food there, and it was amazing. I had the best papaya salad I've ever had there. And that includes from Sacramento, and, like, I've been to Thailand, and that was some of the best papaya salad I've ever had. So for those who have never visited, can you explain the kind of food that's there and also the kind of produce that's there? Because that is also different from what you find at other markets.
So all the produce are locally grown. behind every one of those is a person from the Hmong community that has grown them. The different vegetables, like we love our greens. We boil them with, like, whether it's pork or chicken, you put a little bit of lemongrass, a little salted a little way, and it's amazing. Like, the Hmong people's food isn't so flavorful, but then because we're people that adapt to where we're at, a lot of the food and the cooking came from what they've learned over there is in other countries. Mm-hmm. Like, I know for sure, like, papaya wasn't just a Hmong thing, but mm-hmm. they take it and they make it their own thing. So you're going to see so much of that. All the vegetables there, there's so many specific names for it, and there's just so many ways to cook them. They're not what you'll see at their grocery stores. You can't find them at Nusagaya or Red Apple. You have to go to the weekend market to find them. And they're cucumbers. I mean, I don't know if you've seen them. They're just good, like, and big, and there's, like, I don't know how they did that, but Hmong cucumbers are always usually bigger than, the ones that you see in the stores. We also... The main thing about that market is they're the pork belly and purple sticky rice. That's kind of one of the main themes with most of the vendors there. But you have to try every one of them so you know what flavor you like, because not everyone seasons it the same way. Not everyone cooks it the same way. And so you have to try every vendor before you decide whether or not you like Peña. There's going to be people with different flavors and taste, and it's really up to you what you like. So
there are a lot of choices there, and it's going to be a flavor blast for your taste buds, because the food there is unlike food that you can find elsewhere. So I highly recommend everyone go. And do you know how long the market goes till? Is it the end of September?
Yes, it is until the end of September. So I try to operate the market the first weekend of May to the last weekend of September, with only two weekends that we try to close, which is the triathlon weekend that happens at the Centennial Campground area, and then also during the Hmong Harvest Festival. Mm-hmm. But we are not open on that weekend, so there's two weekends we don't operate.
May, what part of Hmong culture do you personally feel the most connected to?
My God, that one is so hard for me, because growing up here in the United States as an American citizen and having parents who have gone through so much just to bring me here, I feel like at one point I didn't want to be connected to the Hmong people mm-hmm. growing up, because of when we go to school and you have to be more a certain way. But now I learn to appreciate every aspect of being Hmong. And I think that, from the clothing, the food, just the feeling of being, like, in a community where love exists, you'll never get that, I don't think, anywhere if it's not within your own community. And so being Hmong means feeling the ability to love and help each other, and all at the same time enjoying good food.
Absolutely. What do you wish more Anchorage residents knew about the Hmong community?
Well, one thing I would like people in Anchorage to know about the Hmong people is that we're not here simply because we wanted to be here in America. The Hmong people came to America because of the sacrifices they've made. We've lost hundreds of people that died during the Secret War. Our people fought for a country before it even became our own. Our parents came to America not by boat, not by crossing borders, but through airplanes that the United States brought over to bring Hmong people here, because of the sacrifices that our parents, our ancestors made to this country. And so we are here, and we might be Hmong, but we love America. We love this place, and we love Alaska. I love Alaska.
Looking ahead, how do you hope the Hmong culture and community continue to grow and thrive here in Anchorage?
Well, I think, like in any other communities, I would love for the Hmong people to continue to be here. I've heard that a lot of people are moving away. I don't know why, but if they can continue to be here and grow, I'd love to continue to see the Hmong Festival, the weekend market happening, and again, our new 9079 market at the Glen Square. You guys are all welcome to come.
And you had mentioned earlier that you're one of the only communities without a cultural center. Is
yes.
that something that is in the works? Is that something you guys want to try to do?
I do. That's kind of one of the goals that I've had in mind, but it does take some time. You have to do work in your community. You have to show that you actually care about the people. I don't even know where to begin, to be honest with you. But I do know that our work for the Hmong community has been consistent, has been long. At one point, I thought, I'm about giving up. Mm. But I know that there's so much more. And I want our children to learn. I want to preserve the culture, the traditions. And so if anyone knows how I can go about that, feel free to reach out. But yes, it's something I would love to be seen in the works.
Absolutely. May, I really want to thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to be here with us and tell us more about the Hmong community. I think our listeners have learned a lot. I know I have. It's a beautiful culture, and I just really appreciate you and your people being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm host Kim Sherry. After the break, we'll be back with State of Art.
From Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art. Welcome to State of Art, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, I speak with Juneau-based artist Crystal Worrell. You might know her from the massive mural on 7th and G or the Alaska Airlines jet adorned with her vibrant formline design. Worrell, who's also the co-owner of Trickster Company, recently installed a new mural on McKinley Tower in downtown Anchorage and has a first Friday at Dos Manos for August. While things might be finally winding down for her, she's been packing it in this summer.
It's been a 3-year project installing these glass-blown gummy bears, formline style. There's a whole wall of them. It's like a grid of them, and they're really colorful. And it's at the Seattle airport in the new Sea Concourse expansions. It's on the way to the restrooms. And then additionally, doing the mural in Anchorage has also been a 3-year project.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of like finishing up these long-term projects, I mean, how does that feel? Like you're busy, but you're also like wrapping up these huge endeavors.
Oh my goodness. It's definitely been a test of, you know, my endurance for how much I can take on all at once. And, you know, these projects, it's not a one-person labor. I've had to hire maybe a total of 25 to 30 different artists for both projects. And all the artists I hire are specializing in like very specific areas that I need them for. One thing I require is that they all are familiar with my work and that they're passionate about what they do and that they're excited about the project I'm hiring them to help me with. So that's something I'm really proud to share, is that it's given a lot of work for a lot of artists from Alaska and Washington area, and even an artist from Philadelphia. I flew in to help install the mural because I wanted to make sure it was installed right.
Yeah, it's kind of like you're using your own success as you kind of get these projects and kind of spreading the love around to other artists.
Yeah.
You mentioned that mural in downtown Anchorage. It's called White Raven Dreams of a Salmon Return. And so it shows this white raven facing two salmon on kind of this nighttime backdrop with mountains and waves. What's the story behind that one?
The building owner, Jack Pomerantz, he wanted to work with me because a lot of the people that live in McKinley Towers, it's assisted living, and a lot of them are from remote villages. And he wanted something to make them feel at home and feel welcomed. And so raven's the symbol of a trickster, a creator, someone that's playful. And white raven comes from a Tlingit story. A long time ago, raven used to be white. And there's a story of how white raven brought drinking water. And I sort of wanted like this piece to be timeless and not be specific towards like, is it a midnight sunrise? Is it midnight? Is it nighttime? Is it daytime? Because the sun, the moon, and the stars are out. Mm. It's sort of dreamlike. It's a dreamlike state. And it's white raven having a premonition and a dream of what do future generations need, and how do Alaskans, what do we all have in common? It's salmon. It's the harvest of salmon and the migration of salmon that significantly impact everyone in our communities throughout Alaska. And right now, for the past, gosh, at least 6 years, my mom's side is Degaton Athabascan, and we have a fish camp up north, and we haven't been able to harvest salmon there because the return has been low, too low. And so a lot of rural communities aren't allowed to harvest salmon our traditional ways anymore. And so our young people aren't learning how to smoke fish the traditional way, and it's heartbreaking. And so this dream-like state imagery of white raven dreaming of a salmon return is white raven dreaming of returning something to future generations. It's looking into the future. What what are our obligations towards being stewards of the land?
You said that it took like 3 years to complete, but I mean, when you're dealing with something of this size, like something that's going to go on the side of a building, I mean, what's just kind of the rough process to, you know, doing a giant piece of artwork?
Doing murals in Alaska is its own challenge because obviously the weather, the environment, the conditions are unlike anywhere else, and it's very unpredictable. Of course, when I aimed for July because typically July is like the best weather, and Anchorage, I feel like I don't have to worry as much as Southeast. But of course, I fly the artists from Philadelphia, I fly my crew, and I get everything planned and everything shipped and everything printed and ordered. And of course, it's like a record rain for July in Anchorage, the 2 weeks that we're there. It was insane. So we had to be sort of like hurry up and wait and just be on the clock 24/7 with my team ready to go when it stopped raining for a certain amount of time. And we need an hour of dryness before and an hour of dryness after. And so I was really just like leaning into, you know, the all these different apps, weather apps, they're not reliable. And so I'm like feeling the weather in my bones. And I'm like, I feel there's a shift coming. It looks, that cloud looks kind of sketchy. I think we should wrap it up and wait. So it was definitely, I'm not going to say it wasn't a pain, but it really is labor intensive in Alaska to do murals. And they take a long time to plan and to get the resources here, especially for that particular type of mural. That's the second mural I've made that's on mural cloth. Mm. And mural cloth is, it will last for 30 years and look great, but I do need to find sealant for it. And for some reason, the sealant can't be shipped to Alaska, and I can't find the proper sealant. So it's just been a continued challenge, but, you know, I'll figure it out. I'm still looking, and I'm asking people for help on deep diving.
So the mural, like, it obviously, while it has this kind of maybe darker, dreamier kind of vibe to it, it's still very vibrant. It sticks out, like it's eye-catching still, you know, kind of the point of part of the grant that you received. Could you talk about that? I think a lot of people in Anchorage are very glad that we are fighting the beige.
Yes, the funding for the project, supported by the Anchorage Community Development Authority through the Municipality of Anchorage's 2025 Mayor's Beyond the Beige Arts Award. So half of the project was funded by this Mayor's Award, which has been really awesome to be able to get local support by the community. The other half is funded by a fundraiser I put together with the help of the Wild Birch Hotel. My friends who are the Sundog Band played for me.
Awesome.
For the fundraiser. And it was all the art that I've made in the last couple of years that I put up for auction, and people of Anchorage came through and bid on things and got some art, and it helped fund a quarter of the project. The remaining quarter of the project, I'm still tying up, you know, like the budget changes as the project goes. Had to rent a U-Haul to have a dry space to work in next to the mural. So there's unexpected expenses, and then there's other expenses that I didn't have to pay. Someone lending me a car, and so I didn't have to rent a car for $3,000 for 2 weeks in Anchorage. The mural got installed successfully. It looks great. The only remaining part is the sealant. No point in stressing over it, just trusting that I'll find something and it'll work out. It'll be fine uncoated for a couple of years. It won't change, but the sooner I find it, the better, so I can wrap the project up. I've learned to ask people for help, and people are always really excited to help.
Hopefully there's a chemical supplier or somebody listening and being like, oh, I can help you out.
Yeah. Surprising. You think of all states that Alaska would need sealant the most. Strange to me, but I have someone deep diving.
Kind of moving to kind of just some of your other stuff. You know, this isn't even your first mural, even in Anchorage. You've done large scale pieces in like Juneau, Sitka. Looks like you've even done some in like Seattle, and it's been from like basketball courts to ambulances to airplanes. I mean, what is the biggest attraction to kind of public art, or I don't know, do you just like seeing your art on a massive scale?
After I finished college, I went to get my BFA in Studio Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico from the Institute of American Indian Arts. And I got inspired by all these artists working from small to large scale And when I moved home to help Rico, my brother, open the Trickster Company shop, we started thinking like working big, working larger. And we painted a mural in the back of our shop. We're now just online. Since COVID, we've just moved online. And we have a warehouse in Anchorage where I painted a mural in there. So I was doing small indoor murals throughout opening the business, Trickster Company. But I got to a point where I was like, wow, I really want to go large. I want to go huge. I would see these big empty walls and these giant surfaces. And I'm like, those are all canvases. And how cool would they be if they were, you know, like covered in a story by someone, an artist in the community. And so I just decided to start doing it. And I actually got interviewed by the Alaska Business Monthly magazine, and they put me on the cover with my art. And it was during the time I was installing the first mural in Anchorage. And I, in the article, I talk about working large scale. And the Alaska Airlines regional CEO, Marilyn Romano, had proposed to Alaska Airlines that they paint a livery that's designed by a local artist. And she was sitting at her desk and she couldn't decide what artists to pick because there's so many. And that magazine was, the mailwoman came in and put that magazine on her desk. She read the article and said, this is the artist. So that's how that one came to be. And I didn't mean to design ambulances and airplanes and whatnot, but it just seemed natural with the path of working in public art. And, you know, I ended up getting this RFP to do the Seattle Airport art installation. And so it naturally seems like I'm being called to design things towards transportation, which is really cool because a lot of my art is about place and being, but also migration and our connection to those things and each other through the migration of salmon or the seasons of certain plants or the way time moves with the landscape. So it seems to make sense.
You have a First Friday coming up at Dos Manos on August 7th. Yeah, so it sounds like it's going to kind of be like a big release almost, because it's been a second.
Yeah, it's going to be a compilation of mostly Giclée prints of graphic designs that I've done in the past 2 years. And it's going to be friendly, you know, like a lot of the prints might be a couple of murals I've done. And then a lot of the prints are going to be like small things that I've enjoyed in my life designing, like Formline Pokemon, Formline Hayao Miyazaki references, like My Neighbor Totoro. I recently did a Formline Jimothy that's been really popular. So these are just like fun little things that I enjoy off the internet that I wanted to see done in Formline. They're going to be small, tiny prints, so it should be a fun, cute little show. But it's at one of my favorite art gift shops in Anchorage that has been selling my art for years now.
Cool. Are you going to be there? Do you have anything special planned?
I actually won't be there. I'm coming to Anchorage on Sunday to work on the prints and get them ready and get them installed. And I have to leave Thursday because I have a simultaneous First Friday in Juneau for a release of a Fernet coin design that I did for the state of Alaska. I'm doubling down on the two First Fridays in two different places. And I wish I could be at both, but it's just how my entire year has been. It's been utter chaos of multiple projects overlapping.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, it's got to be good to stay busy, but it's probably good to take a break every now and then.
Yeah, I'll have some slow and steady time this winter. I'll be traveling less and I'll be spending more time in my studio to work on paintings, which I haven't done in a minute. So I'm excited for some stillness.
Yeah, just a brand new series, all of Jimothy, various aspects of Jimothy the raccoon.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you'd want to add about anything you've got coming up, First Friday, the mural, anything like that?
No, at the moment I'm just focused on the First Friday show, and I hope people can come and check it out. It'll be up for 2 months, so I hope people in Anchorage get a chance to take a look and laugh and enjoy the little animals that I've done in Formline.
Awesome. Crystal, thank you so much for taking the time talking with me and taking the time out of your super busy schedule. Yeah, good luck with everything you've got coming up.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was Juneau-based artist Crystal World. She recently completed a mural on McKinley Tower in downtown Anchorage. And that's all for State of Art. I'm Ammon Swenson.
Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. And thanks to our guest, May Ramirez Zhang. Ammon Swenson produces this show. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcast. I'm Kim Sherry. Thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.